In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's Medical Emergency Kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies, it is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow.
Richard Serrett's Strange Planet, following the truth wherever it leads, exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites, revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality, coming to you from the Great White North and his studio beneath the stairs. Here's Richard.
And welcome once again to Strange Planet, and on this episode, real sea monsters and other marine mysteries. I always look forward to a visit from Max Hawthorne. He's the prince of paleo fiction, and in addition to being a best-selling indie novelist, he's an amateur paleontologist, a voting member of the Authors Guild, an IGFA world record holding angler, and an avid sportsman and conservationist. He's into archery, fishing, boating, boxing, and his amazing collection of fossils and antiquities. He lives in the greater Northeast with his wife, daughter, and an enormous Siberian forest cat. Best known, of course, for his Kronos Rising series of books. The latest is Kronos Rising Purgatory, Sun, Sand, and Slaughter. Book your timeshare now. And he has a brand new novel out called Slay. That's S-L-E-I-G-H. Slay. It's Christmas Eve. Pray he doesn't come down your chimney. Max Hawthorne, welcome back. How are you, buddy?
I am overwhelmed and honored to be here as always. Thank you so much, Rich.
Whenever I hear Florida, and I was watching the midterm election, and so Florida, of course, came up time and time again. And whenever I think of Florida, I think of you because I believe you have a rental a property down there, but you told me the story about an alligator, your encounter with an alligator. You and your dad, actually, and you fended it off with, an aluminum net or something.
Landing net, yeah.
Do you have any further adventures with alligators?
In Florida, they're, at least in my experience as a fisherman or being around bodies of water, they're everywhere. I mean, I think the population is like nationwide, which is in a few states, is like 2 million animals or something.
Yeah, it's exploded, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They came from being, at one point, being threatened and protected to now they're like, so the, you know, the rumor is that any freshwater body of water in Florida is going to have at least one alligator in it. And it seems like every time I go somewhere, we seem to have experiences with them. I mean, I've been on fishing boats and lakes, which of course are frequented. And a couple years back, I ended up hooking one because we use large shiners, like yay big for bass. And so it's these gators, they start, you know, haunting the boats, fishing boats, so they knew you're using live bait and they'll try and steal your bait. I ended up hooking one and I had him on the rod, you know, for a couple minutes trying to get him off and everything. I didn't want to cut the line and leave him with 50-pound test braid, you know, trailing behind him that could strangle him or something. But so that was one. I mean, we've had the last time I was down there in August, we had a rental and we were the same property and there were three different alligators that were in there. You could see a 9-footer was cruising around like a shark early in the morning. But every time I went out to try and fish and using artificial lures like a crankbait, which makes like a sound like a wounded fish, they'd come charging. And then they see you and they're like, oh, this looks promising, you know? And I'm like, oh, I'm not falling for that again, you know? So I just back up the hill, you know, and I didn't have a net with me, just a fishing rod. So that's even worse, if you know what I'm saying. But there's a lot of them. I mean, they're amazing animals, but you have to be careful.
Right. What's more dangerous, an alligator or a saltwater croc?
A saltwater croc is infinitely more dangerous. Alligators here, at least, rarely attack people. I think it's like a hype thing. Like they look at a person and, you know, you seem like this big towering thing. Whereas grown men have been attacked and killed by alligators in the water, where it's more level, let's say. But by and large, they don't tend to mess with people. They usually go after, I hate to say, but children or the elderly, you know, they're able to sense these things. That's why the one that I had to fight that went after my dad, it was targeting him. But the saltwater croc is much bigger, much more aggressive, is not afraid of people, and will target a human being, regardless whether you're standing or swimming, as a food source, as will the Nile crocodile. So, you know, it's just a step up, I guess you'd say, kind of like a dog versus a wolf almost.
Interesting. And they're related. I mean, they look so much alike, but they're related, right? They're from the same genus?
Family. Same family. They're similar. They all share similar ancestors. I would think a salty would be closer related to a Nile croc or maybe even a mugger. But yeah, they're all crocodilians. Crocodiles and alligators have different head structures for targeting different prey. The gator's head tends to be more broad, and its teeth, upper teeth, hang down. Its lower teeth don't protrude up above the jaw when the mouth's closed. So that's one way to tell them apart. Of course, when you're that close, it's a little late to be checking teeth. You know, do you mind if I just kind of check that? Oh, you know, that kind of thing. But either way, they're predators. They're bigger than us. It's not something you want to take a chance with, you know.
I was right. It was a crocodile. Yes. Congratulations, Lefty. You got that right.
Yeah.
And we often refer to them as, you know, living dinosaurs. Why have they been so successful to stick around for, what, tens of millions of years? Is it because they're just such efficient killing machines?
I think they're ideally adapted to their environment. I mean, there have been crocodile-like animals around before crocodiles during the early Jurassic or even Triassic. And all these animals, but they were very similar in terms of structure, body type, et cetera, and environment. But they have, they're the ultimate ambush predator, if you think about it, especially when they're grabbing prey that's on land and taking it into the water. I mean, you see all the videos of wildebeests in Africa and zebras and things like that. But they have a great stealth tactic. They come at you like a submarine underwater if you're by the water's edge. They usually spot you from, you know, however far back, and then they measure it out. And then their goal is to surface really close to you so quietly and then make their grab and drag you into the water where you can be drowned and dismembered, et cetera. They have foramina, they're called, like pressure sensors, like pits all over their faces that even in the dark, like in pitch blackness, if you have an alligator in a tank and you drop a drop of water in one side of the tank, it'll turn exactly towards that spot. They can pressure, you sense it from so far away. Crocodiles are even worse. Their entire bodies are covered with these pressure sensors. So they can sense anything coming at them from any angle, which is astonishing. You know, I developed a theory, actually, believe it or not, that if you look at these like theropod dinosaurs, like Tyrannosaurus and such, that people were saying why they had these foramina on their faces, you know, and there were like these things going out. Oh, they were sensitive lovers, you know, like they could caress and make out and stuff like that, or something like that. Yeah, I was joking, calling them the cads of the Cretaceous. And
who
stuff
came
like
up with that theory?
Some paleontologist that I guess, you know, needed something to get their name in print. I don't know, but it was. I swear to God, they actually, like, these were professionals putting this out. T-Rex was a gentle lover, and I'm like, I'm finding that a little hard to believe. More like grabber, you know, whatever. But if you look at, they have these on their lips here, on the skeletons, you can see in the skulls in the lower jaw, they have these foramina, see? And it's like on the lips here and then a lot of the jaw here and nowhere else. And then I thought it through and I was like, well, this has got to be a defense mechanism against crocodiles and crocodilomorphs, that type of stuff, which have always been around since the dinosaurs have been around. So when you have a theropod like that, when it goes to drink, it has to drink like an ostrich. It wades into the water a little bit, and then it scoops up water at its mouth, and then it lifts its head up and back to let the water fall down its gullet. That's how they drink. Okay. So if you're even a big, an Allosaurus, whatever you might be, you go into the water, if there's a crocodile as big as you, or worse, five of them, you know, when you go for that drink, you know, you can get grabbed. But if you have these pressure sensors, you can sense the approach of that predator as it's creeping towards you underwater, and then pull your head back before you get grabbed by the face or throat or whatever and pulled in. Because once you're in the water with them, now you've got a problem, you know? So, I mean, I own a piece of huge crocodile skull from, where is it? From Hell Creek. And at first I thought it was a Dinosuchus, but I don't, if it's not, it's something very large, a croc. And it has scores on the head, scars healed from a theropod that it grabbed that had bitten it as it was dragging it in or preying on it or whatever, you know, defensive bites, let's say. But so I think that's why these theropods, they all have these pressure sensors and they only work in the water. So it means that they had to be using them in the water. Why would you have them? They're not fishermen, you know, as opposed to Spinosaurus, which was a fisherman, but it had it all over its entire head practically, which makes more sense if your head's underwater and you're fishing, you know. Right, right. They only had it where the parts would be submerged while drinking, which to me means you're basically looking at something that was protecting itself. Like tigers have these big whiskers, you know, huge. And when they drink, there's whiskers touch the water. It's like vibrissae and walruses. They can sense things through them, and then they know if danger is coming. Lions' whiskers aren't as big, but they still do the same thing, and they drink in groups. So now they have a bunch of them all together with their heads in the water and looking. You see them, they're always scanning, like waiting for danger, because Nile crocodiles will drag a lion in and eat it.
Wow, Max Hawthorne, not just a pretty face, also an academic. I mean, you write scholarly papers, right?
And get harassed for it too. But that's beside the point.
That's right. We talked about that the last time because you burst some bubbles with the or balloons, I guess, with the what's that giant shark? The megalodon. Yeah, because you basically said that the larger megalodons are basically they eat carrion, they eat roadkill, basically in the ocean.
The evidence overwhelmingly suggests, based on just their tooth morphology and the fossils of their prey, that their teeth were designed to break up carcasses, the rib cages to be exact. So yeah, and that's you know, people don't like that. If you take something they're fond of and you expose it as being, you know, not the killing machine that can jump up and take a jet plane out of the sky, you know, if it's something more lowly, there's nothing wrong with being a scavenger, you know. I mean, hyenas are predators and scavengers, and they're quite dangerous animals.
That's right. I was just going to say scavenger. I was going to say ask Fred Sanford, Sanford and Son. I'm dating myself. He was a scavenger. All right, we'll move along. Move along. Now, the Kronos, the creature in Kronos Rising, is that's like a plesiosaur, supposed to be a plesiosaur, right?
The principal villains, we'll call them that, the set pieces, are pliosaurs, which are plesiosaurs that have huge crocodile-like heads and short necks, as right. opposed to the Nessie variety that have the long necks, the small heads, that type of stuff.
Right. So the plesiosaur is which one has the long neck? The pliosaur and then the plesiosaur is.
Well, there's two body types. There's pliosauromorph body types and there's plesiosauromorph body types. Okay. Those are the ones with the long neck. So anything that has pliosaur in it is an aggressive predator that feeds on large prey items. Big head, short neck. Just think of it like a crocodile head and neck on a sort of like body, like a leatherback turtle almost, short tail like that, and four big flippers.
Right.
So moving fast through the water with this chomp, 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 chomp on the end. The plesiosaurs, the long neck ones, elasmosaurs, things like that, would feed on fish that they could swallow whole. Their teeth are designed to puncture, grab, and then they would gulp it down. Some of them had jaws that had like a joint in it so they could stretch a little. So they could eat something about the size of their head.
So is the Pliosaur in the Kronos Rising series, is that, did you like study alligators and
crocodiles
and base the creatures on their behavior?
I studied a lot. There was, oh my God, what was that book called? Sea Dragons, I think it was one I read. It's by a famous author, and he, you know, I'm disrespecting him by not remembering the name right now. Richard Ellis, maybe. But it's a pretty famous book. He had at length there. I mean, he covered ichthyosaurs, plesiosaurs, pliosaurs, everything, even swimming techniques and such. So I read all that stuff. I mean, I knew a lot about ocean life, marine life to begin with, but I really needed to focus on this particular specimen and learn everything I could before I could try and personify it in a book or books. So.
Right. And when you look at the pliosaur and the creature that you write about in Kronos, the Kronos Rising series, I think I like the bumblebee when we look at that and we say, how did that, you know, they still don't know how that gets off the ground, right? Like, it should not be able to fly. Mm-hmm. And I look at the pliosaur and I say, how does that thing move through the water so quick? I mean, it's so immense. Mm-hmm. But I was talking about academic papers. You actually wrote an academic paper, your theory of the locomotion of the pliosaur. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there was a lot of papers about that in the past from the pros and such. And, you know, you have these four animals with four flippers, pretty much all the same or similar in size flippers. You know, so why? I mean, because people look at sea lions or seals, and they have two flippers for propulsion, and the hind flippers are more, a little bit for maneuvering and steering more, but not the main thrusters. Same thing with sea turtles, big flippers in the front, you know, small flippers in the back, which were literally rudders, and the females also used them for excavating nests, okay? So why have, you know, and leatherbacks hit 22 miles an hour, and seals are fast and maneuverable as all hell. So why do you have four flippers? And there were, you'd see all these theories out there. Oh, they use just the front flippers and the back were for steering. And that's like, no, because if you were steering, I mean, look at a battleship. The rudders are tiny by comparison to that giant ship. So that didn't make sense. You know, the rear one was even worse. You don't develop these giant paddles that are so big and muscular and strong and then direct them to directing traffic, like a traffic cop. It's like, you know, nature doesn't work that way. You don't develop a giant long neck is there for a reason. You know, huge jaws with powerful muscles and sharp teeth are there for a reason. You know, you wouldn't have a saltwater crocodile eating grass, for example. You know what I mean? Or feeding on guppies. You know, it doesn't make sense. So they had to be working together in some reason. And then there were theories for that. Some people said they alternated. Front set would go, rear set would go. I actually had that in Kronos Rising because back then that's all I knew was what was available. I hadn't developed my own stuff yet, you know, and some people said it was a figure eight. They go like this and this, like alternating again, but like looping, that type of stuff, or one set worked and the other set rested, you know, different stuff. None of that made any sense to me. And then I was sitting in my hot tub of all things, you know, and I was like, what are we missing? You know, and I think that's the problem with paleontology sometimes is people get so wrapped up with dusty fossils and sitting in, you know, like Smog on his treasure. You got to get out into the real world and, you know, take classes in kinesiology and stuff like I did, you know, objects in motion, movement, anatomy, so that you could put it all together. And I was like taking my hands and I was like sitting in there in the water. I'm like this, this, this. And it was like weird. And then I have like several of my nephews. They graduate now, but they were champion scullers, you know, sculling teams and stuff. I mean, like phenomenal. Reminds me of me when I was young and fit and not fat, but anyway, and we discussed this at length, you know, and I was like, I looked up like the world records for sculling, one person versus two person, you know, you have these oars moving in the same plane, but they only get a 12% increase in speed for two guys with four oars versus one guy with two. You see what I'm saying? Didn't seem like a significant increase. And then I realized I was sitting in the hot tub and I was like, went like this and this and this. And I was like, wait a minute. I'm like, because if you're pushing the same water, this is the problem with sculling. Okay. That's called the principle of diminished returns.
Right.
You're pushing water. It's already moving. See, like this guy's pushing and this guy's following. He's pushing water. It's already swirled out. We'll call it turbulent, et cetera. It's like almost nothing there. He's pushing very little. See? So the same thing would happen to a plesiosaur if the paddles move the same way. But I realized if you had one paddle going like this and the other like that, now you're functioning in two separate planes of motion. So you're pushing two different parts of the water. So now you get double the thrust, double the speed, double the acceleration. See? So then I started looking at the skeletons and such, and papers like from Carpenter, who was a genius, by the way. And you see, like, they talked about how, like, the rear, like, paddles seemed to have a range that was different from the front, but maybe that was for steering or something like that. They hadn't hit it right on the head. And then I looked at the skeletons and the ribs, and you see the ribs in the front and back, like the pelvic ones versus the in the back, like, I mean, in the end up, sorry, and the shoulder girdle, we'll call it, the ones in the front, they had these ribs that were what we call adaptively shortened, meaning like to get them out of the way. Like our ribs on the bottoms here right, are shorter than up top. See, so we can move.
Yeah.
Okay. Where you see Galapagos tortoises, the ones that have their heads that come up high, and the shell has formed a big shelf there so their head can come up because it's not hitting, you know, it's like pulled back
right,
permanently. Okay. So with these, the ribs in the front for the front paddles were short, but the ribs in the back by the hips, we'll call it, were non-existent, which indicates then that those paddles in the back were able to move higher and laterally versus the ones in the front that were more like a sea turtle's. See, and that was the answer. That was the solution to the mystery of plesiosaur locomotion. You know, that's what we put in the paper. It was myself, Dr. Mark McManaman, and a paleontologist from the UK named Paul de La Salle. I brought these guys in with me because, you know, I mean, I don't know everything. And, you know, it's good to work with a team. And they were great.
And it all started in the hot tub. Did you, like, jump out and start yelling Eureka?
Right, like Archimedes. It was my Archimedes moment, you know. You know that story, right?
Oh, yeah, of Rome. Course.
Yeah. Displaced. Yeah, he was... Yeah. In fact, I actually had a computer in one of my novels called Archimedes in honor of him. But yeah, I didn't jump up and be like, I've got it, and run naked and dripping through the house, causing terror in my wake and everything like that. But I knew I had it. I was like, splashed the water. I was like, son of a, that's the answer. You know, I mean, everything else is just, it's, you know, and it works for every species. Long necks, short necks, all these plesiosaurs, they all move the same way. And it worked great for them. And that's why they had them around for like 150 million years or something like that of this, you know, this adaptation.
Remarkable. I'm learning stuff. I always learn stuff. Max Hawthorne, back with more in a minute.
It's time to redefine reality. This is Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
Having lots of fun learning all sorts of things with the king or the prince of... I'm giving you a promotion.
A promotion?
The king of paleofiction, Max Hawthorne, the Kronos Rising series of books, and Kronos Rising Purgatory, I guess the latest installment, Sun, Sand, and Slaughter. Book your timeshare now. A new novella out called The Sleigh. Came out around Halloween, but it's Christmas Eve. Pray he doesn't come down your chimney.
That's actually a full-length novel, 375 pages or something.
Why do they...
This is The Sleigh.
Is it? What? Is it? It's, so it's a novel, not a novella. Or is it?
Yeah, the Purgatory, which is about 100 pages long by length, it was classified as a novella. But The Sleigh is a full-length novel.
Ah, okay. All right.
And it's out in hardcover, too.
Can you, do you want to read some for it? First, let's set it up. This is, these are like cannibals or something?
So the story is that, and this was like far removed from my usual Florida-based, like, marine stories and stuff. So The Sleigh takes place in New York City. Whether it's in the same universe as Cronus Rising remains to be seen. You know, you never know. There may be some Easter eggs in there. But so basically, it involves these two detectives that are new partners, a woman named Ilsa Dunbar and a guy named Andy Aldita. I get so many names in my head now, and I didn't, like, read up on stuff. And they're... For the last decade, Manhattan has been besieged every Christmas season for like a certain number of weeks prior to Christmas by what is believed to be a cult called the Christmas Cannibals. And these marauders will break into people's houses, apartments, and they target families that love Christmas and celebrate and have a lot of decorations. And they kill the entire family and they feed on them, etc. But what's been happening is that apparently, it appears to the police that a member of the family in each case has turned out to be one of the Christmas cannibals, and that's what the cops think is how they're targeting their victims. That may not be true. If you see the cover art for the sleigh and those gleaming eyes or anything like that, you know, it kind of like seems to indicate something else. In fact, how do I shrink this? Let's see here. Exit full screen. I'm going to see if I can get the sleigh up on Amazon, and I can just read the synopsis, I guess you'd say, which would probably be easier than me, you know, like rambling or trying to figure it out. Is that okay?
Sure, sure, absolutely. Okay.
So,
and then I'll get you to read a little bit from it as well.
Would be my pleasure. I'll skip the stuff. It says, the only Christmas cheer this year will be from those who live to see the dawn. For hardened NYP homicide detectives Ilsa Dunbar and Andy Alvita, Christmas represents a holiday of horrors. Every December for the past decade, a cult of serial killers the press calls the Christmas cannibals has chewed the Big Apple to its core. I like that, by the way. Creeping in under cover, I wrote that myself, by the way. But anyway, creeping in under cover of darkness, they bypass the finest security systems and slaughter entire families, leaving wreckage and half-eaten corpses in their wake. But as Dunbar and Alvita's investigation leads them from one horrifying crime scene to another, they begin to realize there is something dark and deadly lurking in the shadows. It is an ancient evil whose roots are wrapped around the most iconic Christmas figure of all. And for those who meet its fiery gaze, the legend of Santa Claus will never be the same.
There you go. The Sleigh, Max Hawthorne's new novel. All right. You're going to read a little bit?
I will. I picked a little spot here where Andy and Ilsa have gone to a holding station in New York City where potentially psychotic patients are brought, people that have been arrested for crimes like that. And when they've gotten there, they find everyone murdered. The place has been destroyed, a desk flattened, there's dead cops, doctors, orderlies everywhere, etc. So they split up. Never a good thing in a problem.
Exactly.
And Andy went to investigate one way, and she stepped out to call emergency services and come back in. So we're now functioning from Ilsa's point of view. Unfortunately, people are going to hear this. This is coming from without all the preceding stuff, but hopefully it'll make sense. After stepping outside just long enough to make a frantic call to emergency services, Ilsa re-entered the war zone that was the city's psychiatric holding center. She picked the furthest car door from the one Andy chose and raced down it without hesitation. Weapon ready, she moved nimbly forward, her senses on high alert. After pondering their situation, the muscles of her jaw systematically contracted. They were obviously dealing with some sort of terrorist attack. I gotta move this screen down a little bit. How do I do this? There we go. There was no other explanation. She had no idea how many scumbags were involved or what was driving them, but to assault a government building that almost always had armed cops on hand, they had to be fanatics. And from the look of things, heavily armed ones. Their motive, on the other hand, was a bit more obvious. They were after Dr. McKinley. Nothing else made sense. The wounded surgeon had undoubtedly seen one or more of their faces. His testimony would put the kibosh on what she suspected was a large and well-funded organization, one responsible for a decade of headline-grabbing murders. No worries. Ilsa double-checked her Glock safety, then felt for her spare magazines. She smiled a predatory smile. The bastards were in for a rude awakening. Or as Captain Janice put it, I can't use an F-bomb on here, right?
No.
Okay, so instead of the duck stops here, imagine something else in its place, okay?
Right.
She ignored the crunch of spent brass underfoot as she worked her way down the lightless corridor. 15 yards ahead, she came upon the remains of yet another freshly murdered cop. She smelled him before she saw him. His bowels vented and skull crushed, lying in a pool of blood. His spent Sig Sauer was still gripped in rigid hands. No perp bodies yet and no blood trails. Looks like L.A. was right. Whoever these a-holes are, I'm cleaning that up. They're wearing military-grade body armor. I guess headshots are the order of the day. Glad I practiced. She stopped as she reached the first holding cell and stood there staring. It had been open, but not via its heavy steel door. A large swath of its reinforced bars had been pushed outward, leaving a makeshift hole over 5 feet wide. No, make that pulled outward, she thought, studying the pattern. What the hell is going on here? Is there some sort of supersized Jaws of Life type tech out there that can do this? Ilsa shined her light through the plume-like opening, then inhaled sharply. The detainees were still there, six or seven of them from the look of things. They were piled up in the far corner, a fleshy hillock of bleeding and broken bodies. They were dead, every single one of them. She could feel her heart starting to pound and focus on drawing slow, calming breaths. This situation was getting more effed up by the minute. She focused her surefire on the collective creak of blood that meandered out of the cell and gritted her teeth as she stepped carefully over it. Then she saw the tracks. Someone had tread in the gore, leaving behind an easy-to-follow trail. A very big someone. She did a double take, then swallowed nervously. The tracks were exactly the same as the ones she'd abused Andy about the previous night, the ones they'd found pressed into the ice outside the McKinley's apartment building. Huge, hoof-like ovals, over 1 foot wide, except these were outlined in coagulated crimson. What in the actual F-bomb? Ilsa felt the hairs on the back of her neck prick up, then chided herself for being a superstitious idiot. Obviously, there was a logical explanation for the draft horse-sized tracks. She was acting like a frightened child. Come on, girl. Woman up. She commenced following the hoof prints, picking up the pace as she realized they would soon run out of ink. They were nearly gone when she noticed they'd curved around, toward a nearby examination room. The door to the room rested on the floor outside. From the look of things, it had been yanked right off its hinges. Steeling herself, she counted to three, then sprang into the room, weapon ready. Her chest heaved in relief as she realized there was no one there. No one, that is, except the person she'd come to find. It was McKinley. He was propped up in his hospital bed. He had a series of straps restraining him and one arm extended in greeting. Dr. McKinley, thank God, she cried, rushing into the room. Ilsa came to a screeching halt as the beam of her flashlight illuminated the surgeon's face. His eyes, skin, and hair were all a ghostly white, and his lips were drawn back in a frozen grimace, a death mask of unadulterated horror. His arm, the one she thought had gestured to her, was extended stiffly outward. Tightly gripped in his lifeless fingers were the old rosary he'd been clutching the last time she'd seen him. Jesus, what happened to... The gunshots interrupted Ilsa's soliloquy. There were two of them, back to back, a double tap. They sounded deeper and louder than the pop-pop sounds made by the usual 9mm rounds. More like a, Andy! Should I keep going, or is that enough, or?
Just finish the
okay.
Couple more paragraphs, yeah. You got me.
Any thoughts for her own safety were forgotten, and Ilsa pounded purposefully down a lightless hallway, searching for the source of the gunfire. Moments later, she found her partner. His body was silhouetted by a faint glow that permeated the end of the hall via an open door. He was slumped against the wall in a seated position, a dazed expression on his face. Her heart skipped a beat when she saw his eyes flutter, and she rushed to him. Dropping to her knees, she ran her fingers deftly over his chest and abdomen, checking for wounds. Andy, are you hit? Are you shot? The sound of her voice caused his eyes to come into focus, and he stared blinkingly at her. He shook his head slowly from side to side, like he was attempting to rid himself of something, then pushed up off the floor, trying to regain his feet. She put her arm around him and helped hoist him upright. Lord, he was heavy. Still out of it, Andy rested one palm against the wall and concentrated on breathing. After a few controlled inhalations, he gave her a nod of thanks. Did you see it? Him? A line appeared between Ilsa's brows. See who? Kid was right. Big bastard in a long trench coat. Nailed him center mass, but he just kept coming. Ran me over on his way. His voice trailed off as he glanced left, and Ilsa followed his wide-eyed stare. 5 yards away, the facility's thick metal exit door was gone, allowing the frigid night breeze and snowflakes to invade the otherwise warm hallway. She could see a streetlight outside and past a nearby wall, the illuminated windows of an office building.
Wow.
Is that okay?
That's awesome. Just in time for Christmas, The Sleigh. You put that on the bookshelf right next to Charles Dickens. It's wonderful, wonderful stuff. We'll take another quick time out. Come back. Max Hawthorne stays with us.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
Max Hawthorne is with us, the prince or the king of paleo fiction, the Kronos Rising series of books, Kronos Rising Purgatory, the latest, and his brand new one, The Sleigh, just in time for Christmas. It's Christmas Eve. Pray he doesn't come down your chimney. I want to shift gears for a minute because I'm fascinated and I have an irrational fear of sharks. I think I've told you about this. Whenever I go to a warm location and I plan on going to the beach, I mean, I always ask the same two questions whenever I'm in a foreign country, if it's warm enough. I say, can I turn right on a red light? And then the second question is, you know, when was the last time a shark was seen in this particular body of water? And so I'm fascinated also by all of these YouTube videos now coming up about, you know, recent shark attacks. Is it just my imagination or are shark attacks really starting to ramp up? Have you noticed that?
Well, I think there's a lot going on. And yes, I mean, obviously, stuff like that always makes the news. People are drawn to that type of primal fear of a predator that can eat you and such. I mean, you know, ever since Jaws, was that 1977 or something like that?
75, you know, 76,
yeah. It's been like a staple. But yeah, I mean, a few years back, there were like large numbers of white sharks, not even big ones, like 7-10 footers showing up off California and stuff. And in other places, part of that I was attributing or theorizing that it might be the result of all the orcas that have been preying on white sharks, like those ones off South Africa. You know, they call them port and starboard. And this is what they do. That's like their prey. You know, the great white shark, as huge and fearsome as it is for the killer whales, is just a mobile, you know, liver with onions snack. In fact, they prefer the liver.
That's what they eat. And they're all liver, right? Sharks are all liver.
Yeah, it's a large percentage of their mass, which is surprising, but it's true. So, I mean, I think it's a known fact that white sharks are afraid of orcas. And they've done tests like off the Farallons where some orcas or a female orca killed a great white to show her infant how to do it. And every white shark in there disappeared for the rest of the season. And they had a tracker on at least one. And they found out that when that happened, it dove to 1,500 feet and swam all the way to Hawaii. So it's like they're afraid of their natural predator and they just get out of Dodge, which of course, for me personally, it seems like that might be a good way to prevent shark attacks is if you have crowded beaches and worry about that, is if you played like occasionally hydrophone of hunting orcas, I bet you every shark in the vicinity would get out of Dodge and not come back, see? So that could actually save some lives and save shark lives at the same time.
That's a great idea. Know? Why hasn't anyone thought of that?
I don't know. Maybe they don't write giant novels about pliosaurs eating human beings and megalodon sharks all day and stuff like that too. You know, I don't know. But, you know, I think it could actually work because it's a proven fact that sharks are afraid of them.
Well, once in a while, an orca or a killer whale will go crazy and unjustifiably so, perhaps, in when it's in captivity, and it'll injure a trainer or something. But, I mean, if you're in the water and there is a pod of orcas in there, would they come after you?
As far as I know, except for that one incident from the 1800s where orcas were possibly hunting a scientist and his who was out there studying them. But people were saying they were after the sleigh dogs and the sleigh that he had also. So that could be the case, but they don't seem to, in the wild, they don't seem to target human beings, not that we know of. And I have a theory on that, if you want to hear it, why that's the case.
That's why you're on.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I forgot. It's funny because when I was reading, I had to shrink the box real small, and I don't know how to make it big again. And I'm worried about disconnecting things, you know? So I just, it's like, that's why I'm looking up because I'm looking at this tiny picture now and all that. But screenshot, exit, minimize video. If I click that, is that going to go big or is it going to?
You're asking.
Let's find. If I do this, I don't want to lose you. Well, I think it's the only option. So let me see.
It's the red wire. Click the red wire.
Yeah, really. Boom. Okay. No, I felt like, you know, it was like this awkward thing. So orcas are matriarchal societies. Like there's a, you know, usually an older cow orca that runs the show and directs things, etc. And the males, despite being larger and much more powerful, they do what their mothers and grandmothers say, etc. So that's how they function. But they're tightly knit familial groups. They're very emotional creatures. And you probably saw that one about the orca mom, her calf died, and she carried the body around for like a week straight.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, in mourning. They are emotional creatures. In captivity in some of these marine parks, they've taken babies from the mothers, and the mothers have gone insane, screaming for days straight.
Wow.
You know, and they wonder why in captivity they sometimes turn on their trainers and stuff. Yeah. But these are highly intelligent animals. They learn, they teach, etc. And so they pass on knowledge from generation to generation. These animals have seen the great whales slaughtered by people going back 100, 200 years. They have watched us annihilate whales that they would have a very tough time or even impossible time tackling and butcher them. You know, I mean, they know what we're capable of. And I don't think they want a piece of that, to be perfectly frank. Wow. You know, they're not normally targeted. There are some people out there that will kill anything, but you know, the whaling industry doesn't typically target orcas because it's not productive. You know, the amount of blubber, the oil, whatever, this type of stuff. So they teach this from generation to generation, and it's a, you know, matter of just leave us alone and we'll leave you alone. That's my personal theory. You know, but I mean, you've seen incidents, I think off Spain or something, where they were attacking boats and stuff. Yes.
Yeah.
But that was because these fishing trawlers are annihilating their food supply. They're starving. And so they're trying to drive the boats away and so that they can have food to eat. See? So it's like if they wanted to sink those boats and kill the people, I'm sure they could. I mean, these are animals that could weigh 10 tons and be 32 feet long.
Right.
They swim as fast as those boats are faster, you know? So I think that's just a matter of survival for them. But by and large, I think they're more like, we're not going to hurt you. Don't hurt us, that type of situation.
You know, amazing.
There's even been, I don't remember the name of the orca and his pod and stuff, but it goes back maybe 100 years or so where, and if I had the info, I didn't know we were going to be talking about this, but I would have it. But this certain pod of orcas, they realized that people were able to hunt and kill the great whales. And so they would, whenever whales were passing through, they would swim to these whalers and they would call out to them in their houses and such and make a ruckus and let them know there's whales out here, there's whales out here. And they would guide the whalers in their whaling boats straight to baleen whales. And then they would kill the baleen whale. And then the orcas would go in and get their first pick of the, you know, they eat the tongue and stuff like that. And after they'd had their fill, the whalers would take the rest of the whale and flens it and everything and render it, etc. And this went on for decades and decades, the whole family of orcas, and they would only trust this particular family of humans. And until the last of them died off, then they stopped it. But that was like a cooperative hunting thing. You know, they would let the humans come in and do the hard part, you know, so they didn't risk injury and all, but they were doing their part. Like they used their sonar, they pointed them right there. There's your bounty, you know. They would harpoon it, kill it, whatever, you know, and then the orcas would get their piece and then they'd go on their way.
Absolutely amazing.
Yeah. I mean, that takes real intellect for an animal to do
right.
That. So.
KronosRising.com, the website, and all of the books, all of the Kronos Rising series of books, the new Kronos Purgatory as well, and the new one, The Slay, just in time for Christmas, all available on Amazon. Where else? Barnes & Noble.
I think B&N carries some of them also, but Amazon's got like an exclusive with me with a lot of stuff these days, which makes sense. They're like Godzilla, you know, and all that. But yeah, you can get everything on Amazon. I mean, you can get Kindles, they have hardcover, soft covers, Audibles, and a lot of them and stuff. So I don't think The Slay's on my website yet. So if people want to get that, you know, it's being put up probably as we speak. But if you go on Amazon, just look up Max Hawthorne. You know, you'll find it. And yeah, it's good stuff. It's a good book. I really enjoyed writing it, you know.
And I enjoyed listening to it. Thank you for
thank
that.
You.
And thanks for hanging out. I always have such a great time. Thank you.
It's my privilege to be here. And I can't thank you enough for putting up with me and my monsters. So,
Max Hawthorne.
A new Richard Serrett's Strange Planet drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Subscribe at StrangePlanetPodcast.com.